Accession number 4602, reel number 2.
Brigadier Sherman, reel 2. You mentioned the food for the local troops. How was your own food and messing arrangements? How were they organised?
We again had to look after ourselves completely. We were not rationed in any way. We did have the facility of the RAF NAFI in Marne, and there was also a very well-known firm called Spinneys in Palestine, who supplied most of the army messes with food that the NAFI hadn't got. And they particularly supplied the mess, the British officers' mess, and the British officers themselves in both Zirka, Marne, and with the cavalry squadrons in Palestine. So far as Marne was concerned, they used to have a coach, I think it was, on the weekly train that used to come down. And that used to be pushed into a siding, and you could get the sort of things you wanted while it was there.
What sort of things could you get locally?
Oh, you could get all the local foods, fruits, vegetables. It was a meat, of course. There was always a Marne lamb is famous throughout the world as being a magnificent meat. I personally think it's only one stage off being tough goat, but it has a great name, and providing it's young enough, it is delicious.
And what did you do for recreation when you were in Marne?
Recreation was, we had our own a tennis court there, we had a swimming pool. One only played tennis with one's pal, and possibly with a British warrant officer, but one hardly ever played any games. In fact, I can't recall playing any games in Marne with any of the local troops, because they were not sport-orientated like a British Army unit. That came much later on and started in Zirka when they began to give them the sort of recreational facilities that you would expect in a normal British Army barracks. Marne never had it, so far as I can recall. I think one has to remember that most of the Arab soldiers would have been married and would have been living in the village and not in camp. This was always a problem, because when one went out on a trek and they had to supply themselves with their own food and that sort of thing, they always left their families behind, of course, in the village. And problems did arise. Wife swapping, etc., I suppose you would call it. And they were never very happy to be out for more than about a fortnight in case they had or domestic problems at home.
Were there any special health problems living down in Marne?
Most healthy place you can imagine. Delightful air. The only problem we had in Marne was water. Water was very scarce. It was well water, and as the camp started to accommodate more people, as the force expanded, and if, for instance, we had both an RAF half company of armoured cars and one of the flights from 14 Squadron there, the water consumption became quite heavy, and the drain on the well made it rather brackish, particularly towards the end of the summer. One of the last things I did before leaving Marne was to carry out a survey with the government geologist as to how we could, if there was any other water we could dig down to improve the water supply of the camp. And this, in fact, was done.
Apart from the RAF unit, were there any other British officers visiting Marne?
In Marne village, which was some 4 miles outside the camp, away from the camp, there was an RAF officer who called himself the station staff officer, which was a pseudonym, call it, I don't know what you call it, anyhow, it was the disguised name of the government intelligence officer, and he had quite a big house in the town where informers could come and call on him, Arab sheikhs, emissaries from Arab sheikhs, who would alert him, I think they were pretty well paid for their effort, to any possible invasion from Saudi Arabia or the Nejd or any tribal problems that were going on in the desert which might require the frontier force to go and sort it out. Because that's what we were really there for.
How much contact did you have with him?
With a particular chap who was there with me, quite a lot, because he always used to come up to drink my drink. And his first remark on arrival was, "It's a long ship, isn't it?" Which meant that I kept him waiting more than 2 minutes for his drink.
Did any other British officers come down from Zirka while you were there?
We were visited, of course, as like all outstations would be, but the commanding officer at the time, who was Colonel Miller, made it quite clear to me that if he did come down to see me, it was because I had done something wrong and that he didn't expect to come down. It was my show and I had to get on with it. But I suppose they came down, he himself would come down possibly once a year. Other departmental heads might visit us, such as the paymaster or the quartermaster, to check that their own detached sections were doing their job and were supporting us effectively. But apart from that, the answer is no, they did not. They didn't come down for any length of time.
What was your reaction to being left with that much responsibility at that age?
Terrified. But I soon discovered what a tremendous challenge it was, and I thoroughly enjoyed every moment of it, and I think it did me a world of good.
Did you ever have any British officers to come down and help you?
No, there was always there were always two of us there, but when I was in Marne, very shortly after my arrival, my company commander, who was, I think I said earlier, became my father-in-law, went home on leave to England, and so for the whole of the summer months I was on my own, not only looking after my own half squadron, but also commanding the company as a whole. And I had with me one other British officer, who was doing his 6 monthly penance, he used to call it, before joining a cavalry regiment in Palestine. One of the rules of the frontier force was that no British officer who was to join one of the cavalry regiments in the lush spots of Palestine could do so until he had learnt how the other half lived in the desert and had to do 6 months with a mechanized company down in Marne. I had an officer who was in fact some 7 years my senior in the British Army, but seniority in the frontier force was determined by your date of appointment to it, and so I was his senior. He was a cavalry officer, and at the time he served with me, the Royal Armoured Corps was formed in the UK, which meant that all the cavalry regiments and the Royal Tank Corps became part of the Royal Armoured Corps, and the Royal Tank Corps lost its corps, its designation, and became the Royal Tank Regiment. And I remember having to keep the powerhouse running late at night in order to complete our argument, because he said he now would have to accept me in the cavalry club and give me a drink at the long bar, a thing he'd never thought of ever having to do to a tank corps officer before.
Did
Very
you find
tribal we are in the army.
Did you find there was a genuine feeling of difference between the cavalry and the tank corps from him?
Oh, it was all very good-natured, but he always referred to himself as the Homme Blanche and referred to us as the Oily Boys.
Did you have any contact with the Arab Legion when you were in Marne?
Very little in Marne, very much more later on, particularly after war broke out in Zirka, when I was in a different job anyhow. But in Marne, the only Arab Legion I really came in contact with was Sir Glubb himself, now General Sir John Glubb. He used to call on me once a month at the end of one of his trips round the desert, looking where he was lived with the Arab tribes and the Bedouin, in order to have a bath and get the lice out of himself. He used to spend probably one night with me. But he was always well known. You could always go out in the desert. It didn't matter where you were, miles and miles from anywhere. If you met a Bedou driving his few camels, and you couldn't even see the Bedouin camp, you just saw this one chap with his camels, and you'd say, "Have you seen Abu Hanaik?" which was the Arab name for John Glubb. And they'd say, "Oh, yes, he was here 4 days ago." They always knew where he was. Wonderful bush telegraph.
What exactly were your duties when you were at Marne?
Well, at Marne, I was essentially a half-squadron commander. But I was selected to do this job in order to complete their training in the more modern weapons they were then going to be equipped with. So far as my military operational responsibilities were, we were engaged in patrolling the Saudi Arabian frontier, which was an unmarked frontier, and so one never really knew whether you were in Transjordan or in the Nij, and also completing the track marking, which is just another name for making tracks across the desert and at regular 20-mile intervals, building big cairns, whitewashing them, putting a letter or some description on the ground in white stone earmarked, which was to guide aircraft who might get lost flying over the desert. The Imperial Airways air route to Baghdad had only just been developed, and there were a number of emergency landing grounds in the desert where if they were in trouble they could land, and there were underground supplies of petrol in cans, water in containers, which it was our responsibility to make sure not only were there, but were still serviceable. The whole time I was there, we never had a single aircraft force landed, so it was all rather a sort of bogus exercise, as far as we were concerned. But in the main, the marking of the tracks was the thing that we had to continue to do, because they were the main routes of communication, if you like to call it, should there be any problem on the frontiers where you needed reinforcements. And of course the RAF made full use of them to find their way about, just as well as the civil aircraft did. And if the RAF flight that was in support of us was normally based in Amman, And in order to find us, they would sort of pick up the tracks and we'd say where we were, so many miles east of C20 or something like that, and they could find us. Because to try to give a map coordinate in that desert waste is pretty useless.
How clear were the frontiers to you on the ground?
The nearest one, I suppose, was Aqaba, which was about 100 miles south. The furthest was a place called ZZ1, which was 220 miles away from us at Marne, and would take probably a day and a half to get to, depending on if you really wanted to get there in a hurry or not. But one normally took a day and a half to get there because it was right across the desert. It was a lovely trip, really. You came across all sorts of wild animals and things. The odd Bedou driving his camels. You want to know what tribe he came from or where he'd come from. And you spent your time just sort of getting there. In my early days, I think I was lost twice in the desert. At least I thought I was lost. But my Arab officer assured me that it was all right, but I wasn't at all sure. So I just took out a sun compass and headed due north until I found a track. And I then drove along it westwards till I came across some sort of marking that I knew, and then I could find where I was on the map. But we made our own maps, and they were certainly not accurate in an ordnance survey way, as these tracks were marked by a very simple method of using a vehicle speedometer and an ordinary compass.
Was the desert uniform in that area, or were there great varieties?
Great varieties. It was fairly uniform in the southwestern corner around the, as I say, the ZZ1 Madara area. That was fairly flat, red basalt. But the rest of the area was very undulating, black basalt. And at one place called Black Rock, of course, a compass was quite useless. It was so volcanic that it just went round in circles. You could get no bearings at all.
How did the sun compass operate?
Well, this is a technique which, of course, was used very much in the Western Desert during the war. It's rather like a ship's captain taking his bearings. I forget what do you call it now. What does a chap do when he takes his sightings of the sun and the stars and the moon?
The sextant.
Yes, the sextant. It was that. It was really a development from that. The sun always shined, except sometimes in the winter, and you could take. It's rather like a sundial by taking the time of day, and where the sun was, you knew roughly which way you were facing, and then by adjusting your opposition to take account of the way the sun was moving across the sky, you could determine how far you'd gone on that bearing.
How long would you stay out when you were doing one of these track marking exercises?
Usually about a fortnight. So you can imagine that it was all right from the Arab point of view, because their feeding arrangements were their normal way of life in the desert, being mainly recruited from the Bedouin tribes. But so far as we were concerned, it was always very difficult. But we used to get a good deal of assistance from the Air Force, who might, if we were out in the very a fortnight, they would probably fly over us after about a week and drop us a few more fresh eggs. I remember one of my commanding officers who I'd been out, in fact, for 3 weeks then. He suddenly descended from the skies upon me and wanted to know why he wasn't allowed an egg for breakfast. I'd run out of eggs long ago, long before then.
What sort of supplies would you take with you out on these desert trips?
Well, you could take almost anything. We always had a water tanker with us as a vehicle, of course, so the water situation was usually all right. We used to take our fresh meat. We had these gas, portable gas cooled fridges, which worked off bottled gas, I suppose you'd call it these days. They weren't very big, but you used to be able to put some things in there. But in the main, you kept everything cool by surrounding it in water, and the heat evaporated the water, which kept things cool. You could take, as I say, marn muttons there, plenty of goat if you wanted it. Mostly tin stuff. At one time I used to take two hens with me in the back of a truck. They used to lay my eggs for me while I was on trek.
How many of you would go out on these exercises?
The whole half company would go. You might leave a rear party behind in the camp. In fact, you would leave a rear party behind, but it would be very small. But in the main, you'll take your whole half company. There were occasions when, particularly in the winter months, when we had this semi-official role of rescuing tourists who would insist on driving up from Egypt to visit Petra across the desert and either lost their way or got stuck or something. So during those months we would probably have to leave one troop behind in the camp for this sort of duty, and we'd only take one troop out with us. We went out as a full half company, of course, largely as a training exercise, because not only were we doing these this track marking and everything, but we also had to carry out the normal military training of driving across the desert in formation and setting up defensive posts and reconnoitering ahead of the mechanized infantry. Proper military training exercises had to be done, as well as carrying out the normal duties of marking a track or seeing where various tribes were.
How much of these tactics or exercises that you were training on had been given to you, and how much did you invent, as it were, as you went along?
Well, a lot of it had been sort of given to me by my training in the Tank Corps on Salisbury Plain. And we were really developing new tactics in the desert. And this is why these old hands were somewhat resentful, because they didn't really see how training on Salisbury Plain equated with the desert.
How did it equate with the desert?
Very well. Particularly mechanized training. I mean, the tank brigades exercises on Salisbury Plain in those days was the beginning of what we know as armoured warfare now. At least we came to know as armoured warfare in the war. And in the Western Desert. And so it was very, very appropriate, although we probably weren't to know that at the time.
Were there special problems about operating in the desert?
One got to know the desert so well that you avoided all the difficult terrain, if you could. There were problems. Of course there were problems. We had an unseasonal thunderstorm in, I think it was about September one year when I was out in the desert, and we were totally marooned on a little... So, well, you would call it a hillock. In fact, it was just a hump in the desert, surrounded by floodwater that we couldn't get through. And we were there for 3 days until it dried up. we always had our wireless van with us, so everybody knew where we were, that we had no communications problems, other than the usual sort of atmospheric problems of wireless telegraphy in those days, and that we might have to wait till dark before we got a decent message through, but we were all right. But it was all Morse code. There was no direct speech or anything like that.
What sort of range was the wireless that you had then?
Well, it had to be in touch with either Marne or Zirka. If we could, if it was easier to pick up Zirka than our own home station of Marne, well then Zirka would be on watch, would pick us up and relay it, probably by telephone, to Marne.
Could you communicate with the RAF directly?
This was always a problem because they had quite different wireless sets and quite different wavelengths and frequencies upon which they operated. But when we were when we operated with them, we used to put, I can't remember whether they put one of their wireless sets into our wireless vehicles so as to make sure they were in touch with us all the time, or the other way around. But we did have a means of coordinating our communications traffic. It rather goes back to my tank corps days when I was called the Prawn Master, when they were first formed, the tank brigade, and all the various our commanders were on different wavelengths to the brigade command, and I had a little light tank and a prawn net. I used to be given the wireless message, handed out of the turret into my prawn net, drive across to the CO who was supposed to receive it and hand the prawn net out for him to read the message. That was the measure of development of communications in the armoured corps in those days.
Besides wireless, what other types of communication did you use?
There's a lot of flag signalling, Aldous lamp, all the old types of signals of those days.
Did you
Aldous lamp we used a lot, of course, because there's such perfect conditions for the, particularly the sunlight on a mirror.
Would one of the local officers be trained as a signals officer?
There was there were signals officers, but they were mainly in Zirka. We had signals sergeants, no higher rank than that, who were almost always Christian Arabs from Palestine, well educated, who could do this work. It was also significant that the Arab Legion, Ghulam Pasha and his had forts in the desert, as you probably were, who all had their wireless stations. They were also manned by Palestinian Arabs who were educated, because the Bedouin couldn't possibly do them. And there was quite a lot of ham traffic between these people.
Did you have much contact with the Bedouin?
Oh, on trek, yes. If we came across a Bedouin encampment, we used to stop and have a menshef with them. This is when we used to find out whether Ghulam Pasha had been about, or if he was... yes, we had a lot. We had a lot of contact with them.
Did you?
When we met them, we didn't go out of our way to meet them, but if we came across a Bedouin encampment, of course we made our name. And we were almost invariably given the usual Arab hospitality of the desert, of a coffee, and if, depending on the who we came across, if he was one of the leading sheikhs or something, we would have to stay and have a feast with him, and he'd go and kill a couple of goats or something, and we'd be there for the night. No alcohol, of course.
Did you ever have special instructions to keep an eye on certain Bedouin tribes?
No, not within the frontiers of Transjordan, because they were then getting more settled in their areas. That before I arrived there, I think there was the Ibn Rufada rebellion, and there were problems with the nomadic tribes not understanding what a frontier was, but they were beginning to get settled because of the building of these Norwegian forts in the desert, where I, as I understand it, Glubb used to recruit with these patrols the sons of rival tribal sheikhs, so they had to get on with each other.
Did any of your men come from these tribes?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Some of the, quite a lot of the mechanized regiment soldiery would have been from the Bedouin tribes. Not a very high percentage because of the problem of their education and illiteracy, but, some of our best soldiers were probably Bedouin. They were certainly the most loyal.
Was there any problems within your units from men who came from different Bedouin tribes?
No, never any of that problem. The major problems of that nature were usually between the Palestinian Arab and the Bedouin Arab. And on occasions between the Muslim and the Christian.